in this final verse, Srinivasacharya is explaining the mood of the six Goswamis. And the mood of the six Goswamis is the mood of separation from Krishna. In Sanskrit, this is known as Vipralamba. Vipralamba means separation, and Sambhoga means union. So this is actually the mood of the Gaudiya Vaishnavas, separation from Krishna, and intensity in separation. They once asked Andhra Prabhu, what's the mood that we should have when we chant? And he said, the mood that we have when we chant is it's a mood of separation. It's a mood that we're longing to be with Krishna, that we're longing to see Krishna. Just like in his song, even George Harrison says like that, I really want to see you, but it takes so long. Like that mood is actually the mood of chanting, that we feel we're some distance from Krishna, and in desperation we're trying to get closer to Krishna, this separation. And even that mood is confirmed by Srila Prabhupada in his famous explanation of the Maha Mantra, when he says that the chanting of Hare Krishna is just like the cry of a child for its mother in desperation. So this is our mood, and this is the mood which will actually help us in our sadhana and will generally help us in our spiritual life, this mood of separation. And therefore last week we said that Guru Govinda Maharaj, he was saying that we are not opening temples, but we are opening crying houses where people can learn this art of how to cry for Krishna. So generally in the material world, when there's separation from someone, then it means if the separation goes on for some time, then gradually you forget about that person. And then you just, you know, redirect your emotions or your attention somewhere else. But in the spiritual sphere, when there's separation, it actually makes the intensity of the relationship even greater. And therefore it's said that this Vipralamba have, or this mood of separation between the devotee and Krishna, is even more intense than the mood of union. And there's greater desperation and greater longing, and in that sense it's actually a more intense experience with Krishna in this mood of separation. So according to whatever capacity we have, we have to try to develop this mood, especially during the time of chanting. And Satsvarupa Maharaj, he would say that if you cannot cry for Krishna, then cry that you cannot cry for Krishna. But in some way or another, this mood of separation from Krishna has to be developed. Otherwise, our relationship will become very dry. So there has to be some sense of emotion that gives life to our sadhana and to our chanting like that. And that life is this mood, as is being explained by Srinivasacharya. Another significant point here is that the Goswamis were looking everywhere for Krishna. Unlike some people you meet today, so-called religious people who say, I know Krishna, I've seen Krishna, I've read everything about Krishna. The real mood of a devotee is completely opposite, that they think they don't know, that they think they're not very great, that they think there's lots more that they do need to do. This is the mood, the true mood of a devotee. So if you want to sum up what the disposition of a Vaishnava is, we say fallen but hopeful. A Vaishnava feels very fallen, but at the same time very hopeful. See, there's two extremes in spiritual life. One is to feel that I'm already there. And that pride of thinking, I am Krishna conscious, I'm already there, means that they're underestimating the power of Maya. And the other extreme in Krishna consciousness is to feel so fallen that you feel hopeless, that I'll never get there. Because in that mood, what you're doing is you're underestimating the power of Krishna. So a Vaishnava never underestimates the power of Maya, and at the same time never underestimates the power of Krishna. Maya is very, very strong, and the devotee knows that. But at the same time, a devotee knows that the power of Krishna is also even stronger. And therefore, there's no sense of hopelessness, and at the same time, there's never complacency or pride. This is the ideal mood that we should have in Krishna consciousness. So the first thing is never to underestimate Maya. We should always feel fallen. One time a devotee left the movement and they came to Srila Prabhupada. And then one devotee said, anyway, don't worry Srila Prabhupada, he'll go out in the material world and you know, he's got all these false misconceptions, so he'll get kicked around in the material world and then he'll come back. And Prabhupada looked at the devotee and he said, just as in the spiritual world, there is no limit to the ways in which you can experience happiness with Krishna, in the material world there is no limit to the ways in which Maya can kick you. So he said, it's not necessarily that everyone will go in the material world, get kicked around by Maya and then come back. Because there's unlimited varieties and ways in which Maya can bewilder you, kick you and keep you away from Krishna. We should never underestimate the power of Maya. The thing about Maya also is that, or illusion, or this material desire, is that it enters into us in a very tricky way. Often it enters into us, the material desires, at times when we're not even aware. I don't know if I ever told you this story, but there was one politician who was married, Indian politician. So he was known as a very powerful politician, and one of the main reasons is because although he was married, he actually practiced celibacy. So it was said, and a lot of his people around him knew this. Did I tell you this story? So he was very powerful, he had a very sharp intellect and this and that, and he had a spotless character, he was celibate his whole life, even though he was married. And so then one time what his colleagues did is they decided that they're going to try and make him fall down. So then what they did is they sent a prostitute. So one night he was in his office or whatever working till late, and then they sent a prostitute. And then she came, and anyway, it's like Haridas Thakur all over again, you know. But the thing is, he also, when he saw her, and then, you know, obviously it was bewildering for him, but somehow or other he maintained his equilibrium of mind, and then he just told her to leave or whatever, and then she left or whatever. What happened is that night he went back, and although the prostitute, he had managed to resist her temptation, that night he went back and he ended up having contact with his wife for the first time in like 30 years or something. So the amazing thing is that the seed of material desire may come up in one place and then it fructifies in another place. And therefore sometimes in the place where all the seeds are coming, we're not even aware. We think, oh yeah, I did that, I went, you know, I watched this, I watched that, I went to this place, I spoke to this person, spoke to that person, I didn't even get bewildered. But the point is, all the seeds are coming, and then what's going to happen is somewhere down the line, all of that's going to come up. So therefore, Tribhuvanath, once I remember, he gave a class to the Pandavasena and all of us, and he was saying, you all are so fearless, because you're so fearless, you can go to the movies, you can speak freely amongst women, you can go and watch TV and this and that, and you don't have any fear at all. You're so fearless of Maya. And then he looked at them and said, but you're all fools, because you'll all get captured. You'll all get captured like that. So, Maya is like that. It enters in places that we don't even know. And therefore, Prabhupada said, the problem with my disciples is that they're not sufficiently scared of Maya. And therefore, one of the most important principles to maintain Krishna consciousness and maintain the ideals that we're striving for is to always have safety in your life. If we try to maintain our principles based on taste, we're going to struggle because we don't have much taste. And our taste is going up and down all the time. But the one way in which we can help maintain our ideals is to always maintain safety. In other words, never put yourself in a situation where you may get compromised, where you may get tempted, where you may get deviated. Because chances are, if you put yourself in a situation like that, then everything else is just going to flow naturally. Because that's our conditioning. And therefore, we have to be very, very careful and very, very conscious about the power of Maya. And therefore, devotee is always feeling on one side very, very fallen. But at the same time, a devotee never feels hopeless. A devotee always feels hopeful. Prabhupada writes something amazing. If you want to note this down, it's very amazing purport. In the 31st verse of the 3rd chapter. Yeah, this is 31st verse, so this is Prabhupada. It says, in the beginning of Krishna consciousness, one may not fully discharge the injunctions of the Lord. But because one is not resentful of this principle and works sincerely without consideration of defeat and hopelessness, he will surely be promoted to the stage of pure Krishna consciousness. Yeah? So Prabhupada says, in the beginning we may not live up to the ideals that we want. We may not reach that standard. But we should never, number one, become resentful. Becoming resentful means, you know, oh, that's the level of ideal, but that's not realistic, that's, you know, for a different age, you know, that's not practical. We begin to say that that stage is unattainable. So, number one, we should never become resentful that we're not at that stage. And number two, we should never feel defeated. Because the mercy of Krishna is so great that no matter how many challenges are there in reaching the ideals of Krishna consciousness, it's all possible by mercy. And therefore, Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami, in one verse he says, I'm lower than the worm in the stool. I'm more sinful than Jagai and Madai. Anyone who hears my name loses his pious credits. And anyone who speaks my name becomes sinful. And then, this same Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami goes on and writes the Chaitanya Charitamrita, or even takes up that very, very lofty service. So how is that possible? On one hand he's saying he's lower than the worm in the stool, and then on the other hand he's picking up his pen and then writing about Lord Chaitanya, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Why? And the answer is, in the verse straight after that, he says, but all glories to Lord Nityananda, by whose mercy I have attained the shelter of Sri Radha Govinda. So, yeah, feeling very, very fallen, feeling very, very low, feeling that he needs to improve so much, but at the same time recognizing that the mercy is so great that it can even elevate me. So therefore Krishna says in the Gita, Devi hiya shigunamai mama maya durateya. This material energy of mine is very difficult to transcend. However, mame vaye prapadyante maya metam durantite. That one who has surrendered unto me, they can easily cross beyond it. So the Goswamis here are embodying this mood of feeling very fallen but hopeful. Another interesting point in this verse is that their mood is always in trying to meet Krishna. they're going all around Vrindavan and they're shouting, "Where are you, Krishna? I want to see you. I can't, you know, are you here? Are you there? Are you under the Vamshivat tree? Are you at the foot of Govardhan Hill? Where are you today?" And they're running around Vrindavan trying to see Krishna. So this is a very interesting point. Because here the Goswamis are trying to see Krishna. They're intensely trying to find Krishna. "I want to see you. Where are you?" At the same time, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, he says, don't try to see Krishna, but act in such a way that Krishna will come and see you. So how do we reconcile those two things? On one hand, here are the Goswamis intensely trying to see Krishna, and on the other hand, Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj is saying, don't try and see Krishna, but act in such a way that Krishna will want to see you. So is it a contradiction? How would we reconcile those two points of view? Should we try and see Krishna?
I think it's typified, epitomized by Raghunath Das Goswami, because whilst he's in this mood of deep separation from Krishna, like he's looking for Krishna, he's trying to find Krishna in Vrindavan, he's also attracting Krishna through his sadhana. You know, when Krishna comes and Radharani comes, I think it's a really nice example of how through our practices and through our sadhana practices, we can attract Krishna like that. But then we should never stop looking for him also.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Very
good.
Yeah. I was just thinking that maybe Bhaktisiddhanta was trying to refer to don't try like immaturely see Krishna, thinking that you can see God, so you mean that first you have to understand first of all, like qualify yourself before you even try to see Krishna. So don't try and immaturely have this conception of God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. One at the stage of pure love and one at the stage of
sadhana.
Mm.
Yeah, this is more like a spontaneous outpouring, and what he's talking about is for sadhaka trying to reach that point. These are all true. And another thing is that when we're reading this, the Goswami is intensely trying to see Krishna, then what's being underlined here is the principle of enthusiasm and eagerness. And then when we hear Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj saying, don't try and see Krishna, but act in such a way that Krishna will want to see you, then what he's underlining in that is the principle of patience and dependence on Krishna. So actually both principles are important. To be enthusiastic but at the same time patient and waiting for Krishna's mercy, earnestly waiting for Krishna's mercy. But your point that, yeah, our sadhana, our practices, that is ultimately what is attracting Krishna. And for us, when we talk about meeting Krishna, that's really what we're talking about. That we meet Krishna through the basic practices of chanting. It was interesting, I was just reading Prabhupada's letters, and in 1967, Prabhupada wrote a letter to Jayananda. And it's amazing, because this is just like 1 year into his preaching, or not even that, a few months into his preaching. And he writes a letter to Jayananda Prabhu and he says, "My dear Jayananda, I have nothing new to tell you. I have no more advice. I simply have this one advice which I have told you before, which I now tell you again. Chant with attention, chant with absorption, and very quickly you will attain the mercy of Krishna. And you will attain the audience of Krishna."
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. In 1967, Prabhupada said to him, "I don't have anything new to tell you. I don't have any, you know, fresh advice. The same advice I'm telling you. Chant with attention and chant with absorption."
But then Prabhupada told Jayananda also, chant even while you're driving. You know, drive, just chant. Like he was. That was his main service, not to drive.
Taxi driver.
But he said, it doesn't matter, drive and chant, that's also one of the problems.
So the significant point here is that it all boils down to the same thing. Like sometimes we think that to advance in Krishna consciousness we have to do something extraordinary. But Ridhananda Maharaj gives the example that if you're swimming and you want to go faster, then you don't need to do anything amazing in the swimming pool. All you need to do is just intensify the same strokes that you're doing and you'll go faster. In fact, if you take your attention away from intensifying those strokes, thinking that something else, then you'll end up going slower. So actually the focus has to be the basics. And in Krishna consciousness, the basics is chanting every day with attention. And of course we know that to chant with attention really is only possible in the morning. Otherwise, we're struggling. Otherwise it's going to be very, very difficult. And therefore, just like when on television shows, you know, if you want the prime time spot when the most people are watching, when it costs you the most, right? So similarly, the prime time for chanting, when Krishna is accessible, when Krishna's audience is very, very close and very, very much there for us to take advantage of, if we don't use that prime time slot, then we're not utilizing the opportunity that's there. So this commitment is very, very important. In any relationship, forget about relationship with Krishna, in any relationship even in this world, if there's not commitment, then the relationship doesn't go very deep. If you do something for someone one day and then the next day when they need you, you're nowhere to be seen, then that kind of commitment will not allow a relationship to go very, very deep. So commitment is the basis of a strong relationship in any sphere of life. So similarly, in our relationship with Krishna, only when there's a strong commitment to doing this, to chanting very attentively, only when that strong commitment is there can we expect that the relationship will go deeper. So when we hear of the Goswamis running around, you know, trying to see Krishna, for us, this meeting Krishna means meeting Krishna through the process of attentive chanting. And in that way we can actually see Krishna. Yeah. I'll stop. Does anyone have any questions?
You know, just this story about the politician who was married in celibate.
Mm-hmm.
Well, basically, you know, he wasn't fulfilling the duty of his ashram. You know, grihastha ashram, you cannot please him. You have to, you know, produce children if you're grihastha, right? It's like, so basically Krishna sent this prostitute as a temptation to get him on the right track. So finally when he made love to his wife, that's when he was fulfilling his duty. So he didn't sin at all.
So not that grihastha has to have children.
That's a duty. Why are you married then?
For example, anyway, it's quite interesting. I was reading the grihastha manual yesterday. We're doing this Bhakti Life course, I thought, because I sent it to you also. And actually in that there was a whole section on children, and it was actually saying that grihastha, if they're not having children because they don't want to take the responsibility on, or because it's troublesome, or for some reason like that, then it's not right. But there can be bona fide reasons in which a grihastha couple doesn't have to have children. Mm-hmm. Although Chanakya Pandit says a house without children is empty. But still, there are examples of grihasthas who don't have children, so that's permissible. It depends on what their service to Krishna is. Maybe they've come together to serve Krishna in a certain way, and for that it's better to have a family life without children. And in that sense, it can be permissible. So it's not stereotyped.
But then they're more like vanaprastha, married and vanaprastha. That, you know, if they have. So that's another short.
Is that what Prabhupada instructed his disciples?
No, like generally there was. He would always instruct. Like this is the general that grihasthas will because like a woman is called Stri. Stri means expansion. So that's the, like the nature of a woman to expand. Like that. So, and yeah, that generally happens, you know, when man and woman comes together. Bhum Shastriya Metani Bhavi Metam. Atho. Okay, so when a man and woman come together, Atho, Griha, the first thing is there has to be a house. Kshetra, then there has to be some, you know, field of activities that they engage in, work and so on and so forth. So the first thing that comes when man and woman come together is house. Atho, Griha, Kshetra, work and other activities. Third thing, Atho, Griha, Kshetra, Sutta, children, Aptavidir, wealth, and all this. So generally that's how it goes, it expands like that. And so generally in the general circumstance of a man and woman when they come together, that's what's supposed to happen. So he wouldn't say that, he wouldn't instruct like, no, or, there may be exceptions like that. Just like in the general case scenario, if someone is staying as a single man, then they should live in a brahmachari ashram. But there may be very rare circumstances where someone may not live in an ashram but still remain single. So then exceptions are there. But it's not to be taken as a rule like that. Any other questions?
So university, you're talking about me like seeds. So it's obviously millions of seeds.
Millions of seeds.
Every day. So how do you burn them?
Burn them. I think the power of a seed of material desire is when you consciously allow it to enter also. Then that seed is more powerful. So like you're walking across the road and there's so many billboards, or you're going to the university and there's so many okay, women and so many things there. But if you're consciously trying to avoid it, then the seed of that desire is not as bad. But when you consciously let something enter, thinking that it won't affect you, then that's going to have more damage in your spiritual life. Because it means there's a certain complacency on your part. And then I will expose that. So it comes in like that. So that's the nature of the world that we're living in. Like Prabhupada says, Ajamil saw the prostitute once and he fell down. You know, but you know, in the Western world this is a regular sight, day in, day out. So he goes, what chance do the members of the Krishna consciousness movement have? So then he explains that therefore, you know, it needs to be very attentive and cautious not to entertain these thoughts, you know, to be very strict so that we don't get bewildered by it. Any other questions?
This is a bit vague, but you know when, like you say at the beginning, that you speak about the Brahma Bhav and how Andrew said this is really much in which one should chant, and Prabhupada also said that. Like, how do you like kind of bring that mood when we chant? Is it a bit, because it feels like artificial right now to try and feel separation from Krishna when I don't even know who he is properly.
Yeah, we may use different things to develop that longing. First thing that we can use, which is a much more real thing for us, is that we want to get out of the material world and we want to go back to the spiritual world, which is like a very tangible thing because we experience the misery of what it means to be in this world. So even to chant with that in the beginning is useful for us. Just like in an advanced stage, one is not thinking, I want to go to the spiritual world, but in the sadhaka stage, one is thinking, yeah, I want to get out of the material world. That thought helps. So similarly, we may say that, oh, I, you know, it's loving Krishna and being with Krishna, that's too far for me right now. But one thing we can definitely connect with is the desire to leave this material world, which is a temporary place of misery. And so that's, we can use that. And then as Satsang Maharaj said, cry that we cannot cry. So just think that, you know, we can chant with the frame of mind that not only do I not love Krishna, but I don't even have any desire to cultivate that love for Krishna, and in that mood, cry and develop. Like this, if one chants with some intensity or some kind of emotional investment, of course it's not just from the mind, it has to be natural. But then the chanting will be, it's easier to be attentive, that's my experience. Otherwise it can become very dry and mechanical. But everyone does it in their own way, so whatever works for you, ultimately. So we can use different meditations like this to speed up our journey out of this world and increase our desire to go back to the spiritual world.
When people feel like emotions in kirtan, or just they cry in kirtan, or just generally when they cry, is that like them, how do you know it's coming from the heart, or if it's just your mind? And you're saying that it has to be natural, not from your mind.
Yeah. That's why japa is very powerful, because in japa we get exposed. In kirtan, anyone can get, you know, because there's so many other things. You see, song and dance are the two most intense, or two of the most intense emotional expressions. So, they work in a material sphere as well. They give you a very, very emotional experience even in the material sphere, and also in the spiritual sphere, if it's done going to spiritual purity. But in japa is devoid of that song and dance. It's just you, your mind, and the holy name. And in japa, then, is we are getting exposed. In kirtan, we may think, yeah, I'm very absorbed. But then when we sit down the next morning after a great kirtan, and we sit down and put our hand in the bead bag and we try and chant, then we realize that actually we don't have any taste at all. So that's why japa is very important. Sometimes people say, but the Yuga Dharma is Harinam Sankirtan, Sankirtan, chanting together, congregational. So why did Prabhupada institute chanting japa as a sadhana for everyone? Maybe we should just all do kirtan together. And in fact, in the Gaudiya Math, if you go, when we're having the japa time, they're doing bhajans together in the morning. That's like their sadhana. Yeah, so if you go to many Gaudiya Math temples in Vrindavan, and you go, you know, if you're having a hard time in your japa period, and you go on, you know, they're between 5:30 and 7, they just do bhajan, they chant together.
They don't have to do their japa at all?
In some Gaudiya Math temples, they don't specify as much.
Well,
they may do less rounds, 4 rounds or something like that. So, but why did Prabhupada institute it? Because in japa is we're seeing where we really at, you know. And so that helps us to understand whether our emotional connection or a bhava in a kirtan was actually genuine or not. Because then we know when we sit down and we chant japa, then we'll also get a similar connection. But it is also possible that in a kirtan one can get a genuine spiritual experience that they may not get in japa. Because in kirtan, the fact that you're surrounded by so many devotees, and that creates a certain energy. And therefore it's said that in that kind of sphere, the emotions or the emotional ecstasy of others is also pouring onto you. Just like it said that the holy dham is dripping with bhava. So when one goes to the holy Dham, then one can actually experience that. Not that they're qualified themselves, but because they're just in the vicinity of a place which is just spilling with it, so they also get a taste of that as well. Or it's said that the pure devotee is overflowing with bhava. So when one is very close to a pure devotee, even though they may not be qualified, just because they're in the vicinity, they also experience something. So similarly in a kirtan where so many devotees are chanting, then okay, one may experience something. But one should understand that even in such an experience, generally it's not our advancement, but it's just the power of the situation which is boom, bringing us up. But then, as I said, the next morning when we sit down and chant, then we know where we're at. And therefore, Prabhupada would say that your japa is the barometer of your spiritual life. If your japa is good, it means your spiritual life is good. If your japa is bad, it means you're going to struggle. No matter how successful you may be doing, you know, no matter how many people may be recognizing you, no matter how much name and fame we may be attracting, if our japa is not good, then bottom line is we're struggling. And that should be the alarm bell that helps us to get back.
Like you said, you know, it's ideally, you know, best time to chant in the morning. But what if, like, you know, sometimes, you know, you go to bed late, like, you know, like, I don't know, yesterday, if you were up till 11 or midnight or something. So then in the morning, you know, feel tired, or, you know, if it's cold, you feel sick. So it's a bit more difficult to chant all your runs, and maybe you can chant some runs. To chant all your runs in the next morning, maybe you have to go early also. So how do you deal with that kind of situation?
So therefore one has to prioritize what's most important. So you have to know your boundaries. If you know after a certain time it's going to be difficult to wake up, then go to bed earlier. Just depends where you want to put the focus, where you want to put the attention. Shiva Maharaj says that the 2 hours that you chant, actually that's just a manifestation of what you've done in the other 22 hours. So we sometimes think I'll do whatever I want to do and then 2 hours I'll just sit down and I'll be really attentive. But if your other 22 hours aren't supportive of that, then you won't be able to do that. And therefore it just requires, if one sees it as an important thing, then you have to make the time, get to bed early, wake up early, to shift the hours of your functioning. But often we don't want to change, because our habits are that bad.
But sometimes it will still happen that you have a program, you know, late program, and so even if you can regulate most average you can do, you know, you can do in the morning most days, but still there will be some days, right? Like, you know, in the morning.
It's interesting. We were talking about Govinda Prabhu yesterday. How he's very heavy. Listening to some of the Brahmacharya classes recently, and in one class he was saying that they kept a standard in Chaupati from Bhakti Rasamrita Maharaj's time when he started the ashram there, that even if someone would come late from a program, that they must wake up. They must wake up and chant. And then he was making an interesting point that sometimes we say, I went to bed late, so then I should wake up late so that, you know, when I'm up I'll be fully rested and then I'll chant really well. And then he made the point that, but then observe your rounds. When you do, say you sleep in and you wake up at 9, 10 o'clock or whatever, and then you chant well rested. See how you chant. Is it really that much better because you've been well rested? Or is it just really inattentive anyway? And he said, better to get up and struggle and be and struggle to chant at that time than to get up late thinking that, oh, at least I'm well rested, because the whole environment is not conducive. And then he said, he's making the point that, and if you feel that repeatedly late nights are stopping you from waking up early and chanting, then just shift around your schedule. You must chant in the morning, otherwise Otherwise, it would be very difficult to connect with the Holy Name.
But at the same time, we also say that for chanting Hare Krishna mantra, there's no hard and fast rules. So we say you should chant it right, but there's no hard and fast rules. So how do you... what is the truth?
Yeah, there's no hard and fast rules. But Prabhupada said chant 16 rounds. That sounds like a hard and fast rule to me.
Because for Gayatri mantra, you know, there's very specific times, right? You have to chant. But Hare Krishna, you can chant all any time, any
situation. Prabhupada said chant 16 rounds.
When you're driving, when you... Yeah.
Prabhupada said chant 16 rounds, right?
Girai Swami like said even, like I remember one class he gave at the manor a few years back, and someone was asking, is it okay if I chant, you know, usually of course it's not recommended to chant during Bhagavatam class, but someone was asking, you know, I'm chanting Maharaj, you know, Maharaj is saying, okay, but don't tell anyone. So, you know, like chanting, you know, anytime you know, like, you know, hard and fast rules, so how's
that? Yeah.
And, but still, we have some rules, you know, so how?
Yeah, so there are some rules. Prabhupada did make certain hard and fast rules. And we even recite the 10 offences against the Holy Name, which sound like hard and fast rules.
Mm.
Don't maintain material attachments. Don't, you know, disobey the orders of the spiritual master. Don't blaspheme the Vedic literature. Don't give some interpretation of the Holy Name. These all sound like hard and fast rules. So whenever Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is speaking like that, we can understand that different things are being stressed by different statements. And when he says there are no hard and fast rules for chanting, what he's really talking about is compared to other Vedic processes of elevation, which require incredible, intricate, detail, attention to detail. Chanting is very, 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 very simple. But even within that simple process, there are rules that we have to follow. And because we're complicated, we make it out that those rules are very complicated, but they're not. They're not. Prabhupada said, just simply chant and hear, and then he gave certain parameters of how to do it, you know, in the morning, in the association of devotees, like that, to help us.
If for whatever reason we don't chant during the Brahma Muhurta period, then is it better to chant still earlier in the day? Sometimes if I miss the morning, then I feel like it's good to chant just before I go to sleep or something. My mind's quite clear. But it's a work.
Yeah, sometimes they say this period at night time, like 7 to 9 or 7 to 8, like that. That's, you know, it's kind of like a nice time to chant if you haven't chanted in the morning. So I can understand that, but at the same time the problem is, or the danger is, that if you leave it right till the end, then it may end up that something comes up and then you just push it back, and then okay, you're chanting at 9, 10, 11 o'clock at night, or worse still, you don't chant the rounds at all. So in that sense, although sometimes doing it later in the day may feel like it's a better time to do it, you always run the risk that you may end up not doing it at all, or you may push it back and end up chanting really late in the night, which is definitely not good. And therefore, generally, even if a devotee wakes up late, then it's the first thing they'll do to make sure that at least in the day I've got it done.
And another question.
Yeah.
If someone close to us passes away, then we feel really deep separation from them, even without trying. Yet, you know, it's said that the love that we once had for Krishna, we have inside, is stronger than the love we have for anyone else, and even the other way around, the love that Krishna, like the extent to which Krishna loves us, is very intense. So, in one sense, we should be able to easily feel this separation from him when we chant, but I don't.
Why is it so difficult?
Yeah, so then, why is it so difficult? How, like, how can we practically reinstate that feeling of separation? Is it just like reading more about Krishna, like Krishna book and other things, so we really start to see him as a person?
So the first reason and the example of the jaundice is the one that comes to mind. The jaundice person feels sweet things to be very sour. Why is that? Number one, cause disease. So the first reason we feel attachment for the things of this world and no attachment or taste for Krishna is because we are in a disease condition. We're so much identifying with the body and the mind, and we've forgotten who we really are, that all our priorities are upside down. So the first thing is that we're diseased, and how to come out of that disease, Prabhupada says, just keep eating sweet things. So, of course we can read about Krishna, and that's very powerful, but ultimately chanting more and more, and chanting attentively more and more, gradually reawaken that natural attachment that's there.
One statement in Granma Prabhu is like, if you're not chanting the Brahma Muhurta period, you cannot be considered a serious practitioner of spiritual consciousness. It's like, just like a wrestler, like he has to train very hard. And then, but if you say, oh, who are you wrestling with to train? And I say, oh, I'm training with Abhishek, you can't be considered like a serious. If I say, I'm training with, if I'm training with like Nimai, then you can consider it serious. Like big Nimai, you can consider it serious because you're training hard. It's like, oh, if you're not training, you're not serious.